Is everyone still there?
I'm still here.
All right, so we haven't lost anyone. Good. Does that mean Till's on now?
Hello?
Hello, Till.
Who is there? Hello?
I'll go
there?
Hi, I'm here.
I'm Tim Daniel. Oh!
Who is there?
I'm here, it's Tim. Tim Wu.
Hi.
And Dan. Yes, sir.
Hi.
Can we get a password? Linux Foundation, one word or lowercase.
PWG, anyone has slides at PWG? If so, please send the PDF upload it to the website or send it to me by email or directly to Andrew by email so that we can distribute the slides via HP Virtual Rooms and also project them here.
No. I have just this instant arrived at the open.
But if we don't have slides, we do this session without slides. Here we don't have slides.
And send me an email if there's anything at all I can do, or, you know, give me a buzz on the phone and say, hey, you know, read your email. But I'd like to more or less continuously scan my email.
Did Glenn ever give you the updated JCAPI slides? I only have the ones you sent the comments that they were wrong. Otherwise, we have no content to share. I never got any reply. I never got any reply from him. All I have is the old ones. We don't want to share them.
So I will look with, because I think for this session, for with the JCAPI was planned for this session.
Yeah.
Yes, because to this session I did not attach slides.
Well, then we have nothing to share, so we'll just make it free form.
Yes, I will check my email again.
For those on the phone, we're slightly disorganized. We'll be with you in a moment or two.
nothing here. Another problem.
Yes.
Four years, 2007. Montreal, you came to Montreal.
Are you sure?
No, it might be 2006. Atlanta. Right. Yeah.
Yes, the first one. Eric.
PWG folks on the phone? Yep.
Yeah.
I didn't get light.
Yep, you're there. Okay. Till's trying to find Glenn's later JTAPI slides. I don't have. Is Glenn in the room there?
Yep.
Glenn, did you ever update those slides after Till's comments and send them somewhere?
No. It just has Till's long affiliation. That's the only thing I would have changed.
All right. I'm emailing them to Andrew, who is set up to share here. Hang on a second.
And also upload them to the site.
Not this instant.
Yes, yes.
You can do it.
And first pass them to
I'll email them to you both. Oh, you got them, Phil. Oh.
Which day I got them?
Got me. I just found them by a Google search here.
Then simply send them to me again.
Okay.
Because I don't find them. I have a lot of emails from Glenn, but nothing with an attachment.
Behind a firewall tomorrow. What that picture for?
They're out of your outbox. Not my
inbox. Ah, this file I think I have. No, it's a file name. I see it.
It's the same file that you had before. So for those on the phone from PWG, a three-way catastrophe has arisen with the MTF SIM release. Rick Landau is working very hard on it, but it looks like only two of our classes, if that, are going to make it into 29, and they just changed some basic rules on us a day before the final build. So it'll be another 4 months. Can't do anything.
Okay, thank you.
We fire this critter up at it is. It's done warming.
And for the people on the phone who will not use the HP virtual rooms, in some minutes the slides will also be available as PDF
on the server.
On this session.
In the agenda.
Yes.
Some slides for JTAPI, the real intent here was to be completely freeform and talk about any topics that PWG folks thought that open printing could help with or the other way around. But anything of mutual interest where we could collaborate and help each other. So it's not just JTAPI at all. We brought up the topic of job ticket API, which we call JTAPI. Because job tickets are obviously key features of IPP everywhere. And the job ticket API is actually has a C reference implementation, and given parsers written back ends, can parse to an abstract object model any job ticket, and it was designed to be able to represent a JDF or a PWG job ticket. So it is a, it would take some work, but we have proposed it as a Google Summer of Code project, and if it is not staffed in Google Summer of Code, I would suggest that interested vendors or independent contributors, we try to find the funding and people to get it done in this summer's time frame, so that we've got it by the time that we're trying to do some prototyping in the fall for IPP everywhere. And for everyone in this room who doesn't know that much about IPP everywhere yet, you'll learn more tomorrow because this is just the order we're coming to. But it's a new project for mobile IPP.
The question, Ira.
Yeah.
So for IPP everywhere, I want to define like IPP attributes to control the single feature. Are they using job tickets?
IPP everywhere will be able to use the attribute that we proposed 5 years ago in IPP to send a job ticket by reference or by value as well. But in addition, when an IPP everywhere job reaches a server which is forwarding it, for instance, with a JDF job ticket, it has to take the IPP attributes, the inband attributes that wrapped the job, and convert them to a job ticket. Because you can't, right, if it's not IPP all the way through end-to-end to the final device, then you can't keep the job ticket and simple IPP attributes wrapped around the job, right? And you could kludge it and stick it in the PDL, and we have determined we are not, we are going to strongly recommend that never be done in IPP everywhere or in cloud printing because it's a catastrophe of interoperability. So the slider tickets are part of the plan for cloud imaging working group as well as for IPP everywhere project.
So if a printer supports IPP everywhere, is there a need for a job ticket?
For an external job ticket? No. But only if the client originally emitted the job in IPP and all the intervening infrastructure passes it in IPP, right? But the intervening infrastructure may well be classic print spoolers that can attach a job ticket separate file to the data stream, right? So There's no presumption that in every case IPP everywhere is real time all the way from the client to the final destination. I mean, obviously that's the best user experience, but that isn't always the case. And for cloud printing, that's never the case. There will always be a delay and a transshipment through a server within the cloud.
What I see is that two mechanisms for passing job control information.
Right.
One is through job ticket, one is through IPP attribute.
Right.
So both things need to be supported.
Right. Even in IPP, because you might want to use no IPP attributes and attach a JDF job ticket because the creating application created a JDF job ticket for intent, right? Didn't understand IPP at all. Said, here's a data stream, here's the job ticket to go with it, and job ticket is in JDF. Or the job ticket is in Adobe Job Ticket, ASCII Job Ticket, whatever. Even using IPP as a transport, you can't depend on the fact that the client can insert IPP attributes to show intent in the IPP submission. The client may not actually be able to speak IPP at all. He's a mobile phone, we hope he can, but that's not a foregone conclusion. exclusion. And for the cloud use cases, it's rarely the case. For the cloud use cases, an external job ticket is the only practical or the common current mechanism.
But right now, between cloud servers, they're using exclusively ICP attributes to pass printer settings.
Right, so far. That may also change.
I know, well, I mean, JDS, I know, is not very interoperability. Interoperability is really always a problem for JDS.
I was using JDF as an example. In any job ticket format, including a PWG XML schema based job ticket, is still not IPP in-band addressable. And you cannot assume real-time connectivity all the way from the final target device to the client, who's probably your cell phone, right, or your mobile device. I mean, partly because of, you know, intermediate servers store and schedule, and they may delay it. So there's no, you know, they're not just joining together two ICP pipes. I don't know if anyone heard any of that on the phone, but George Liu was asking about why do we need a job ticket with IPP, and I was trying to explain that if we had pure IPP all the way through the whole print path, and the cloud, we don't. Well, maybe not in some cases anyway, but we can't guarantee that in all cases. That you can't constrain the cloud infrastructure, nor if there are three cloud servers federated in different cloud offerings, can you possibly constrain it? So the assumption is that you need to have an external job ticket. Certainly for cloud printing, and often for IPP everywhere for mobile devices, because the mobile device is actually going to create a separate job ticket and it doesn't know how to speak IPP and put it in attributes. All it knows is how to do the one attribute that says, here's the job ticket, which allows a smaller implementation, right, of an IPP client, simply. So, Glenn, have you guys got the slides showing in the room?
Yep.
Would you like to talk to them and let Andrew spin slides here in the virtual room?
You can do it, Ira, in the meeting. They're standard JTAPI slides. Nothing will be confusing.
Okay. Carry on, Andrew. Slide two. Okay, so this is some background for those who have never heard of JTAPI, which we usually pronounce JTAPI. I don't know why, but that's what we do. It's the Job Ticket API, or Application Programming Interface. It's an abstract interface. The specification has it entirely abstract. Header files and the reference implementation are in C. What is not in the reference implementation is a parser or a backend to parse a particular job ticket format. But all the logic to call a parser or the opposite, an encoder, a marshaler, and write a job ticket is there, and there are the operations for it. So, objectives to create and consume job tickets, but not define a new job ticket. These were our objectives in designing the API. To be job ticket syntax neutral, which is why inside of a library implementation of JTAPI, abstract job document, finishing, stapling, so on, objects that map one-to-one to the classic ISO DBA model is a method of exposing the content so that properties and so on have names that are not there, similar to IPP attribute names and the corresponding JDF attribute names
but they are not necessarily the same, and the encoding is, the abstract encoding is a little less opaque than, say, a JDS job ticket is, and much less complicated. To isolate the application from the content of the job ticket, so the application here, the application being a print spooler who's trying to forward this job, right, convert it to another print protocol, embedded in the PDL, I didn't say that, or something, needs to be able to read the job ticket, find the user's intent, decide how to satisfy that intent with IPP attributes or with whatever the forwarding protocol is, which may not be IPP. To be programming language neutral, which is why it's actually an abstract model, and their IBM internally has written Java and other bindings for this API, and to import and export multiple job ticket formats. So the other thing that a JCAPI library with several backends can do is to convert from a PWG XML job ticket, which is our attributes that do correspond closely to the IPP objects and attributes, to a JDF job ticket or vice versa, or if you had an additional backend from a vendor proprietary job ticket, there are a lot of them, into a standard, an open standard job ticket, because the library would do it for you. You'd read and read in the one job ticket, it'd get parsed by the backend module, it would go into the abstract object model in memory and be able to be written out in a different format. Next slide. Okay. Notice that in January of 2005, we released this specification. We worked on it for 5 years.
In weekly form, I think.
Yeah, in weekly form.
Weekly Claudia, or Olympic, and Glenn, I think, also participated.
And Tom Hastings, who was then at Xerox, he's now retired. Claudia Olympic.
Olympic, I think.
No, it's ick. It's not itch. Claudia Olympic is with InfoPrint Solutions, which has now been spun off from IBM and sold to Ricoh, and is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Ricoh. And Jody Goldberg from GNOME also participated. Actually, others did. These are the, and it says that Till was at Mandrake. He was then, but that's 6 years ago.
Yes.
Next slide.
A little bit outdated.
So, existing job ticket formats, interestingly, although there have been later releases, and there is a 1.4 JDF now, this really hasn't changed much. There are only two open standards for job tickets. All of the others are vendor or ISV proprietary. And the PWG job ticket is an XML-based job ticket. The PWG semantic model 1.0 is simply an XML representation of then, in 2004, all of the attributes and objects defined in any IPP protocol stack, which means that it hasn't caught up to the next 150 attributes and a couple more objects. So we would need to extend the abstract spec to make it complete and comprehensive. But it would be pretty easy because they're mostly, I mean, we really didn't add new objects much. Kind of, you know, added new properties to existing objects. So there's, you can see in 2005, JDF 1.3 was scheduled to be released in mid-2005. It was, I believe there is now 1.4, and I can't remember if 1.5 is released. I don't know. Okay, so I think there's at least one later release of JDF. Next slide. So this is the abstract object model. So notice it looks dramatically like ISO DPA, ISO 10175, because that's exactly where the abstract model for IPP
and all of the PWG standards came from, and it has continued to guide that work. And so we have, you know, a job ticket, which has a job, is associated with a job, and might be associated with a document, because if you only have one document in the job, normally you don't create a document object, you just send the document data stream along with the job. And then it has contact info and destination and subscription, that's the IPP subscription object, and separator sheet and page ranges and force page, which is sort of like pace ranges. It's about forcing a first page in a beginning of a chapter, and insert sheets and page overrides. And the reason it's in white because it means we didn't write it in, we did do it, but it's not in the abstract, it's not in the reference implementation yet. Since then, the page override spec has been updated in PWG. And in the core object, notice, which inherited all of those, job document page, there is also the media object and more finishing, folding, hole making, which is drilling, stitching, binding, which are kind of similar, it's stapling versus stitching kind of thing, and trimming. Next slide. So, in the 1.0 release of the abstract spec, and with the header files, we had completed C header files for each object in a separate file, common extensible methods for attributes, which allowed you to add new attributes. So actually, you could use the existing C headers and you could add new IPP attributes and it would work just fine. You just have to declare the, you know, semantics of the data type and the ranges and so on the attribute. But there's a method to act, add new vendor or later standard attributes to any of the objects. An object model is object-oriented. Yes, it is. If anyone reads this back, you'll see it's strongly object-oriented. And it defines object familiar to the printing industry. We just saw them on the page before. And defines relationships between objects. Again, the relationships between the objects are per the ISO 10175 model. It's not reinvented. It's the same object model that's been there for 20 years. Defines operations to be performed on those objects, and here these are the operations within JTAPI, not the, you know, the over-the-wire create job operation. And attributes of the objects and well-known enumerated values of all the objects. In the C header file, there actually is a constant that defines every enumerated value with a rather long prefix in it that makes it unique and human readable or fairly obvious. There are abbreviations simply to avoid making names too long to store in a C or other programming language, but other than that, it's standard. Next. Okay. So some detail, and we'll just look at this briefly. These are some of the actual ABI calls. Create a new job ticket info object, and in JTAPI, the job ticket wraps the job and the document object. In the PWG semantic model, the job contains a by value or by reference a job ticket. It's a small there's the same ambiguity in JDF. You can kind of do it either way, but here we were dealing with a job ticket, so it's sort of a root. Get a job ticket from some external job ticket file at a URI, which means read and parse that external job ticket, and one of the parameters is what format you should expect it to be in. Is it a JDF or a PWG XML job ticket, or is it some other encoding? The third one creates a job ticket from data in a buffer
this is sort of like, I have job ticket in memory because I'm in a workflow chain, you know, maybe I'm threads in the same application. And then the fourth one is, given a job object, create a job ticket that corresponds to that job object. They externalize the job attributes and make them into a job ticket, which is, you know, the sort of converse of taking ITP attributes and, you know, putting them into the job. And then there are these write operations, and they are called write, but what it really means to encode and marshal into a concrete job ticket format the model that you now have in memory of some job and its job ticket. So it, the presumption is that you have enough memory to hold all of it. It doesn't deal with the issue of too little memory to hold it. You have everything. You have the whole tree in memory, and you want it to be serialized into some actual job ticket format. And the same thing, you know, write it to a buffer, which might be because you're in a workflow and you're about to pass it to another thread who's going to take the finished job ticket, use it, or do more work on it, make more annotations, or to write it to a URI that is write it to a file. Then for the job itself, there's create a new job object without specifying a document, or create a new job from the document. Again, you got a document object, it's got a bunch of user intent, document processing properties. What you want to do is move them up a level and abstract them and put them in the job proper and its job ticket and not in the job document object. And for the document, same kind of operations, create a new document object. This means in memory, in the abstract model. Or create it from a file. Here's a file that points at it, and what's in that file is a document object in some serialization. Next. So, there's more details here, and I'm not going to read through all these, but basically there are operations for other major. In DPA, these were first-class objects. In IPP, there are often complex data types that are simply directly stored on the job. That is, they're properties of the job. They're not first-class objects. So there's, you know, destinations and subscriptions for notifications. Here, our model was the IPP and DPA subscription object. So, and that is actually conceptually simpler than the JDF subscription, which can be quite complex. Next. And here's even some more ones that work on media and page range, and so on. I can see we have an interesting typo there in page range. But anyway, next. Even more. So now we're down to attributes. This is what I wanted to tell you about. There's this create a new attribute object having provided an attribute name, value type, and value. Destroy an attribute. So you can actually attach and detach individual attributes from the various objects in the model. And these are what the primitive operations are. You do that, you don't. From the calling application, you don't create a whole job object. You create an empty job object and then you start attaching attributes to it, which correspond to the IPP attributes. And then add a value. That's of particular interest when you have an attribute which is multi-valued and you need to add another value to it, another enum, another key. Get the name of the attribute. Given that I have a pointer to an attribute, what is the name of the attribute? And which, so that hidden inside the library is the actual storage of the name, so that the application doesn't directly write the name. He asks the name, or in new attribute, he says this is the name. Store that in a manner somewhat like memory managers in Mello. It hides the details of where these are stored. Get next value, which is
get the number of values, because you need to know, perhaps because you're about to malloc some memory to copy them into. Get the type of attribute values. This is somewhat like get name. This is recovering the metadata about the attribute. Replace an existing value and reset to the first value, which is the iterator about get next value. It's how to get back to the top if I want to walk the list again. If I walk part way down the list and I think, oh, I want to go back to the top. Next. Okay, so there are these other, okay, so there's, the first one is to free all the memory used by an object in the API. So this is the high-level equivalent of free in C language. Find an attribute having a specific name, that's get, and set is setting an attribute having a specific name, in which case you have to supply all the appropriate metadata for the attribute. If you do the set, you got to say it's value type so-and-so, and here's the value, because if you don't do that, it's going to come back and say, no, no, it's the wrong value type, or, you know, out-of-range value. Set an integer attribute is a convenience function. Set an object attribute is another convenience function. Set an attribute list and set a string attribute and set a string attribute list. This is not an exhaustive list, although I think if we go to the next slide, we'll see a few more. Oh, no, we won't. Okay. But there's a couple operations that we didn't list here that effectively allow you to declare to the library a new attribute which was not known to the library. Notice that your backend had better know about this, or you're not going to be able to write that attribute out. But if a generic implementation of the library existed and you plugged in a new backend that understood 50 more attributes, this is how you would stick the extension attributes in.
Ira?
Yeah.
At this point, I'd like to mention that within the specification, not the code, we also covered environments ranging from mobile to production.
Right.
Key point.
And so there's an idea that you have more or less complex job tickets according to the environment, and we were attempting to satisfy the requirement, the operational requirements of operations all the way from very low-end mobile devices to very, very high-end mainframe kind of devices. Thank you, Glenn. That was a good point. So there's a whole bunch of enumerations that are defined abstractly in the model and that have C header representations, and given that there's a complete set of C headers, there are actually tools you could go use these days that would go give you the equivalent Java headers, or with not a lot of effort, you could create the equivalent Java headers or other programming languages. So there's just a whole lot of enumerations that we had. I think this is a, no, it can't possibly be an exhaustive list. It's a highlights list. Next. Okay. So this goes to your question, George, earlier. All print jobs, large and small, require two components, namely a job ticket and print content. In classic pay-for-print printing, where you walk into a print shop, they wrote a paper job ticket, and they still call it a job ticket. And JDF's roots were to make a machine-readable and interchangeable form of a paper job ticket, and part of the reason that the whole JDF spec, which is over 1,000 pages, is so complex is because it attempts to deal with specialty industries like prepress and high-end graphic arts applications and so on. So the relative complexity of JDF is partly because it tried to solve the problem for
forms of a job ticket, all the way from paper to various electronic forms, to forms that are hidden inside comments in the PDL. But that's a pretty fragile mechanism, and it's getting more and more fragile and worn as time goes on, the hiding it in the PDL. Okay. I guess we'll leave the slide up for a moment and everyone can read it, and then we can move on. So at the bottom here, though, we refer to specific bindings as a separate project, and the idea was that what I've been loosely calling a back-end, but the encoder and decoder of some known job ticket format is a module you would plug into the JCAPI library and then, you know, have available. So it would know if you said right to JDF, use that module that told you that it was a JDF encoder-decoder. George, have you got a question?
No.
Okay. So these slides, which Glenn put together recently, were for our Google Summer of Code project. Obviously, we have to do a little update on the affiliations of some of us since then. But otherwise, they remain, you know, they remain pretty correct. And we have great hopes of getting one or more students working on this project. And if we don't, then I will appeal, and others will appeal to vendors and to independent developers to consider working on this, because it's a critical piece. We need core IPP everywhere, and it's an absolutely critical piece for any standards-based cloud printing. Where the job ticket is certainly external.
From 2008 on, I'm organizing the Google Summer of Code for the Linux Foundation, and all these years, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, I have opened a JTAPI for two students, and in all the time there was one student who has applied, and we have accepted him. But he bailed out at the first day of the coding session. So in all the 4 years, we didn't succeed to occupy any of these student slots.
And of course, because it's not UI, it's not user visible, it's not perceived as much as fun.
Yes, printing is not sexy. Printing is a part of the plumbing of the operating system.
Printing is an important
part. The plumbing of the operating system seems no one wants to do.
Printing isn't important.
Well, when we go into the operating system, to the kernel, there the people apply. I have a lot of applications for the kernel, but for, yes, the Linux Foundation is also doing the mentoring for kernel projects. There are a lot, but on the printing level, it's really a problem.
And so the thing is, the simplest complete implementation of JTAPI is one backend that understands a particular job format, can read and write it, and the core library that can allow you to manipulate attributes and create daughter objects like for finishing and so on, and create the abstract model of a specific job that you want to be able to encode with the backend. More complete implementation, or a more capable implementation, would have several backends plugged into the core library so that you could actually begin to do conversion between job ticket formats. And as anybody who's looked at JDF, even the digital printing subset, knows, it's pretty darn complicated, so getting it right once is a lot easier than getting it right many times. And interoperability, you're right, George, is a problem with JDF, and it remains a problem. But if we had a robust and fairly complete library that covered all the scope of IPP, PWG, XML, and coding of IPP, either one, and the corresponding properties in JDF XML objects schema, then we would have, there would be some details and some specialty industries that maybe you couldn't do right off the shelf, but 99% of the real printing work in the world for everyone would just work, and the, and with real fidelity, even if the job ticket did have to be converted from JDF to IPV attributes, or from JDF to
From what I understand, 99% is not work in JDF between different vendors.
Right. That's why I was saying it could, a good, robust reference implementation of encoding and decoding of JDF job tickets could then become a sort of a vendor-neutral test bed that vendors could take their real existing examples of JDF job tickets, drop it into it, say, aha, it breaks the parser in about 80 places. Maybe there's, this is not a very good implementation of a JDF job ticket, and it would begin to improve the quality of implementation. And after it did that, in the second phase, it would maybe begin to improve the ability to interoperate better, because that's really, that's a very serious problem. JDF job tickets work pretty well with the same vendor's code generated them at the client who parses them at the printer, but they otherwise don't work very well in many cases. I agree. It's a problem. But it's a problem we can't entirely solve. It's a problem we could help improve.
I think the problem is JDF is too big. And I actually have different interpretations of the feature myself. A simple duplex feature. How to put duplex feature in JDF? There's many ways of doing that.
Right.
So I participated in a couple of simple JDF interoperability tests. Last year, they held that in Newport News, Virginia. And the year before, they held it in Foster City. And they are struggling to interrupt each other. Nobody interrupts each other except that, okay, I have two vendors here. They set up some agreement, and I share out my JDF implementation, and you share out yours, and hopefully it works. But still, it's not working.
Because the spec is so big and complicated, and because, as you say, there are more than one way to do a lot of simple user intent things in JDF. But that's where a standard library that wasn't coming from any single vendor could start to help, I think, just by saying, you know, eventually this becomes the de facto standard for here's the way to do that. Right? Here's the way to encode duplex, for instance. You know, as in
people do have a reference implementation in both Java and C. I'm not sure how it's C, but they have Java. And they have even have implementations inside the printer and applications. I mean, it's big mess there.
Well,
I think the big problem is they're trying to do too many things. And for our printing, what I think what can be done is, because right now, look at the cards. They don't even have a job ticket format. And then, they can cover pretty much all the features. But that feature is only probably a 5% of what this JDF can represent. So,
It's more than that. The intervening 15 PWG IPP extensions added hundreds more attributes and more objects. And there's a lot better, not of all of JDF, but I meant of the digital printing profile of JDF. There's better coverage, potentially, now. But in any case, it's not necessarily a JDF job ticket.
Right.
But the job ticket, if it's external, is not simply going to be a file with IPP attributes in it, although that's a lousy possibility. It would be the PWG XML schema, which has a 100% accurate semantic mapping to the IPP object model, because it was written
by three or four of us from the IPT standards. So, and there were IPT, Tom Hastings, the author of IPT, the author of DPA, the ISO standard, were on this working. So we were rather careful about if we had a choice, if we had to make a choice, IPP wins, not JDF wins. We just, you know, okay, there's this divergence for JDF.
There's a way to resolve that, let's say, for JDF, to have, they put ICS.
Right.
From 50 components, some system, whatever.
Right.
So what I think, if, let's say, between top servers, they can tell plan, okay, we are going to use job tickets rather than IPT attributes to transfer the job settings, and then also we pass that setting to back to printer. In that way, it makes more sense, okay, we have a big set of attributes, we know the scope, so everybody can implement.
Right.
That, if you just say, oh, JTPI, JTPI, yeah, the JTPI is part of RICO now, so I'm familiar with JTPI. It's not really, I think, to make it usable for everyone, they have to set up a scope. Scope cannot say we have a library that do everything. That can never work. It's too complicated.
So you would perhaps downscope the library to take out some features?
I think we've been too up. I think we're going to do too up in JDF.
I know.
It's terrible.
It is terrible.
Mark off guy and go, oh.
Yeah, whereas 2UP is rather easy in IPP and in the corresponding PWG schema.
So I think
it's just,
I understand the importance of our job ticket.
Yeah.
Which is critical. It's kind of after we change from PostScript to PDF. Because PostScript can embed device control command, the PDF cannot.
Right.
So naturally, we need a job ticket server. So I think we first need to limit the scope, what they are going to do with the job ticket server. Not just to do everything, they cannot.
Well, we won't be able to do everything in the first effort, right?
Good.
And the first encoding library will probably accept a job. It may or may not even accept a document object. And it's not going to accept any of these other first-class objects. It's going to accept simple intent objects that go directly on the job, I'm sure. Because it's just a matter of you start and you build the first piece, and you build the next piece. If it was me, I would build the job object, and then I would build the document object. And then I would build media and all these finishing objects as needed. Like, stitching makes sense, but hole making, it's good. Many people, except in print shops, ever drill holes. Not too many. How many $20,000-$30,000 multifunction devices actually drill holes? Not many. You can buy the, you know, extra component you attach, because often from a third-party vendor, but, you know, it could be downscoped, certainly. You want to spin the next slide here, Andrew? Okay. So this was the objective for the project. There was a proposal that I wrote to the printer working group for an actually even simpler non-XML, an actual textual job ticket called micro job ticket that was still following the exact semantic model. It was just sort of a way that you could serialize this into a file. For instance, if you didn't have a robust XML parser that you were willing to fix the bugs in, and you needed something, you needed simpler job tickets. Honestly, I think micro job ticket idea may be worth considering. So, micro job ticket proposal was a different encoding, a non-XML encoding that is closer to the pure IPP attributes, sort of a flat serialization in a file of the pure attributes, with some mechanisms for shortening the names to make them encode quickly. Actually, to use tokens to make them encode very small. So this Jay Chappie were describing an approach to the project. Review the API, review the PWG job ticket specification, which is the XML schema for print job ticket is the object in PWG schema. And create a test job ticket, manually create a few job tickets, you know, just put them in, if for an XML, you can still hand code XML. Put them in text files so you can have something to do exercising with. Define a command line test application for JTAPI. For the initial set of commands, this goes to what George was saying. Of course, you don't do all the commands immediately. You do the minimum amount of stuff that you would have, even the attribute. There's, as you saw, a rich set of API calls for manipulating attributes. You don't actually need all of those simply to be able to create attributes. And if you don't need to read the attributes, parse them, change values, and so on, which is all icing, then you could do a much smaller implementation of the base library first, and then, you know, in a back-end and encoder and serializer for a job ticket format, which, again, could even be a text format. It might or might not even be XML to start. Create a thin thread implementation. Okay, so that's buzzwords. You know, thin thread means, you know, rapid prototyping, you know, without great complexity. In my experience, it usually means all of the errors print a message. But something like that. And then enhance the individual JT API calls, for instance, to add the optional parameters, add more calls, you know, richer set of calls for the manipulating the objects and their attributes. And enhance the test application to provide full functionality, and we would have to define what full functionality was, which is what George was talking about, and then to do a project demonstration. Okay, so this is Cogent. The license of the C headers, we did this on purpose this way, is CPL, which is a much more commercial vendor-friendly license than any form of GPL, because it does, says you do not have to give back code. If you want to take this and fork it, you can, and you don't have to disclose that you've done it, and you don't have to disclose additional code that you've done. That's your choice. CPL is a variant of MIT license, I believe. So, the coding language is platform-independent. This is the intent, and this is how we wrote the reference implementation. It's platform independency, that is, it never uses vendor extensions or platform-specific extensions or extensions that only work in some particular C compiler, but not all of them. That there should be inline commenting in the implementation. Not just a block header that says, for the next 1,000 lines, we'll be doing this, but actually every 5 or 6 lines, there's an actual comment that says, here's what's going on in the next few lines, and in every function, there would be a function header. If you look at the actual C reference implementation of JT API, you will see that there are is a very thorough documentation of every function. And operating system is any, and where Glenn said non-GUI, he meant you don't have to write this so you can sit there with this pretty front end to get at it. It's fine if you can just do it from the command line and from control files that you specify on the command line. Because practically speaking, that's all you ever need. Because the end user won't create a job ticket. He'll interface to some printing
GUI. The printing GUI might create a job ticket because he knew what he was going to do is print through a cloud computing infrastructure, and it required a job ticket. Wouldn't accept a PDF that had embedded comments. Didn't want all of the interoperability issues of that. And so it's literally up to the implementer on what platform they work, because it shouldn't matter as long as they write pure C and as long as they write dash strict on the command line options when they do the compile. So it's like no extensions, no breakage, and tell me every warning and don't build if there are any warnings. Set the warning level all the way up to, what is it, 4? 34, I think, is the highest warning level. The interface of the project would be command line. Partly because of time constraints, but also because in the long run, that's probably even more usable to wrap it. You can wrap command lines with applications. You can't wrap somebody else's GUI with your application, usually. You get all problems about screen scraping, basically, you know, to do so. And the minimum output would be a document about how to build the JT API library, you know, with reference make file, and any notes about any particular dependencies that would be surprising on other libraries, which hopefully one minimizes. How to build the test application, the test application command line instructions, the command page for the test application, and examples of using the test application in JT API, and that was those earlier three actual job tickets, concrete job tickets. Here, parse these, you know, and now sitting here at the command line, I could add these two properties to it, and I could say, okay, now write it out again, and that would be a reasonable test. It's not important that you add a whole lot of things. It's that you read in and you see all of the properties that were in your example, and they show in the, you know, when you read them with the get operations in the API, that all of the content shows that it was correctly parsed, values are there, value types are correct, and then modify something, delete one of the properties, add to whatever. Something quite simple, because it's not important to do a very extensive change to it. It's just to exercise the add and delete attributes, add and delete values, primitives inside the library. Okay, next.
That's it?
All right. I have not been keeping track of time. Until has another topic. It's 5 after.
Yes, it's ah, yes, yes. A little after 3.
You mean that clock up there on the screen?
And our session goes until when?
Until 3:30, but we can end earlier if we want to. For those in Cupertino at Apple, are there any questions or feedback or ideas or suggestions?
No one's speaking.
They're all overwhelmed.
Yeah, absolutely. No comments.
Okay. Besides job ticket handling and, for instance, the job ticket library, the JTAPI library, are there other... Mike Sweet, this is especially a question for you. Are there other pieces of infrastructure that we need to make IPP everywhere work, or to make the IPP binding or the web service binding of cloud printing work that open printing could help with or should help with?
I can't think of any specifically. If we do embedded job tickets, say, in a PDF file, if that was required for a transport, then there would need to be infrastructure support on Linux to be able to read and write those job tickets in the PDF file, but aside from that,
essentially, Mike, since that the embedded properties in a PDF are still basically comments, right, at the front like they were in PostScript, it would be sort of another back end that's serialized to a flat file that you could embed in the PDF, I assume.
Correct.
So it would just be another output format to serialize to.
Right.
Do you think that, well, I mean, do you have a sense, Mike, that we're, Andrew, that we're labeled in the cloud computing, in cloud printing era in particular, to need that as opposed to external job tickets? It seems to me that almost all of the cloud printing efforts that I've seen offering use an external job ticket of some form.
Yes.
Because they want to separate the data stream from the intent.
Exactly.
Email or the FTP folder are two exceptions where the embedded job ticket is the only way that you really get.
Oh, right. Yeah, if you've got hot directory type implementations, then where you push it and then somebody picks it up a while later, you're kind of stuck. Or else you could wrap it in a zip file.
Wrap it in a zip file, some configuration, pre-configuration on your account. It's still an external job ticket. I don't know of any implementation that would actually accept some sort of internal job ticket for this format.
Embedded inside of the PDL.
Right.
Because if it did, then it would have to parse them out because it wants to enforce policy about what intent is allowed. Like, this user, I'm not going to do duplexing for him.
Right.
Right, because he didn't subscribe to the premium service.
He's not a bigger format, so.
Right. Sorry, we didn't hear that last.
Adobe job ticket format is still fairly widely used.
Yeah, I was thinking of that one. However, Mike, in the cloud printing context, I think Andrew at least was suggesting it'd still be external. It wouldn't be shoved down inside of the PDL.
I would certainly hope so.
And it's actually the Adobe job ticket, which is still very widely used in much commercial printing, was one of the other possible, a lot easier to write libraries for parsing than the JDF one. The JDF one is probably a lifetime project you should start young. You're still going to be writing this 30 years later. But, I mean, I can personally imagine writing an Adobe job ticket one or a PWG XML encoding or micro job ticket corresponding one. A complete one that actually covered all the known IPP attributes in a reasonable number of man months or man years to where you could actually get into maintenance and not just still be in development years later. And soon is when we need all this because cloud printing, cloud computing commercial vendors are offering a variety of printing solutions, and the only thing that I probably shouldn't say this, but the only thing that is common among them is that they're all different. And so it's kind of, you know, that every application has a different printing GUI, kind of, you know, and some applications will always want to have unique printing GUIs because they think their domain is terribly important or they want very, very specialized stuff, but unique printing GUIs are not user-friendly, and neither are unique print tickets and unique transports and everything for printing, because that's not going to scale. And it's not going to allow federation between different cloud computing offerings either. If anyone in the room in Cupertino or elsewhere, if anyone else is on the net, has any other ideas or suggestions, please send a note to the printing architecture list or the printing summit list. Till and I will pick it up and forward it accordingly, or send it to the PWG ITP working group or cloud imaging working group lists, and Andrew and Mike will forward it appropriately. And I think we're, unless we have another topic, we're going to go ahead and adjourn a few minutes early here on this topic, take a break before Till begins to do a brief tutorial on what's new in building Linux drivers at 3:30. And thank you all for calling in. I think we'll adjourn. And we're leaving the bridge up here, Mike, because we, in order to have a recording of all 3 days, we're leaving the bridge up even if no one has called in.
Yes.
So you can go ahead and drop.
Yes, and any everyone who wants to participate in the next session, simply stay on the phone or call in at 3:30 again.
So Till's going to be talking about some of the new developments relative to Linux printing drivers, in particularly signed drivers, so that digitally signed drivers, so that vendors can distribute with a link from pointing to them from the open printing page, and distribute binary print drivers or not. But anyway, distribute drivers from their own repository rather than from the common repository.
Has provided some coffee for us.
That would be nice.
For the next session,
the slides are on the...
They're linked on the agenda page, I think.
Yes, they will not be all presented and not in the order as they are.
Oh, yes, they will. The man driving the slides says the order.
But then no one will understand it when we...
Well, okay. Well, we'll have to jump around then. You'll have to forewarn Andrew.
Okay.
Hope you will have a great project with them, and also get in contact with Ira and with Mike Sweet to assure that the city will get a project which is not only for that college,
right,
but will be an interesting project for everyone, and I believe to you as a part of Linux history, might be the provide.
Great. Which one of these 39 million things are we doing?
Probably stand up for this.
These guys, one thing which is always dealt with me on, PWG, he said,
you make a PDF to PDF, right,
the PDF.
Yeah, I know, punches.
Popular is a PDF.
Yeah.
We can get it the library.
Right.
So
I know.
Can
and
finding leak it to
but again, see, that's where I get it.
And it comes with every...
I take a picture of myself. If you
want
to print it on my printer
and hold it every day
or through cloud infrastructure that I subscribe to or register to. Either way, there's no... There's no none of that.
Already a lot making use of.
There's shrink to fit. Print. One up.
Right
there. You know, there's...
Oh, there's...
I want it in color. I want it in down sample. You do it right there.
Okay. You can obviously provide it that if you want to force it.
Right.
But in the power situation, I think that's where I'm going to back up.
He doesn't know what you're saying. And that's one of the best things you want to make a new team of PDF driver,
right. That you make it based on the open setting interface.
Yeah.
Because for this interface, there's one both.
And it's not just too expensive, it's too expensive to implement, it's too expensive to keep regression testing every time.
So the user, the tricky way to get
features,
distribution,
can
choose whether the data flow
comes to IPv 2.1, they would the page range is mandatory to support.
You can, and it's all there, you can come out with it in time.
Oh, okay. Right.
And by me, that's the distribution way depends on driver tickets and drivers when things can use.
You can use extensions
in the end time.
Just kidding. You would have
at least
which is now obsolete, replaced by IP.
Alright, we'll be going to them. I'll be right back. Are you going on to get the butcher? go to one slide and have another one. If you're jumping around, you need to tell them which slide to go to.
Yes, yes.
There.
Yeah, we're in a break at the moment.
Okay, good. Yeah, sorry.
I can't speak yet, and the other guy also not, so we wait a little bit. The wait till the coffee is long, the coffee is on the other floor, so... And I don't even know that I'm the other floor, because I'm just about to... On the other floor, I have to go down the way this place is there. Yes.
Chromatic PCR color.
PSL
color, PSL.
Yes, yes, they are nearly equal.
Right.
Yes, nearly the same. The major, it's only the quinta name, and there are some exceptions, some few exceptions. One can enter exceptions, but there are only a few where we really have exceptions.
I did some change for our own model, can customize the paper size and the tree, let's say. Yeah, but the problem is the performance wasn't good.
Yes, we must look into the PCL, again, the PCL6 driver, the CXL, mono CXL color driver, of course, how to get that faster, or whether it's better to drive a new driver, new PCL6 driver, which is interfacing via the off-sensing vector interface to both the off-class.
Your phone copy back with my tablet.
Yeah. Danny led me. Send you all the keys. where the munchies were. Speaking of which, for everyone, one flight down, there is coffee and cookies.
And food, you have also found that we have get the chance to get fat enough so that we can get a t-shirt.
Oh, yeah. Well, something. Man, that thing cranks out some heat, doesn't it?
Drivers, and when as we have only a 1.5 hour session, one cannot do a tutorial from the beginning to the end, and probably some people have already been last year in the tutorial, and it is perhaps not so nice if I simply do it again. And so I want to make it then more or less a questions and answers session, so that if you have any questions, especially if you are interested in participating in the driver auto-download technology and put up drivers. If you have any questions for this, I would like that you ask them now and we can help you. So, anyone?
I'm from ESI, Electronics for Imaging. We have not bundled any drivers. Can you give a short overview of how it currently works?
Yes. Yes, one thing is I could even do a small demo so that you see what the client user will see. So I take the plug off the projector now, and for the people on the phone, this week, unfortunately, we cannot share because I'm on the newest version of Ubuntu, and this version does not support virtual rooms. So one can see it only in our room.
That it has shown something different on the projection screen. One thing that I don't get now.
Yes, it looks like that it switches, but I must at first look into the screen configuration. It seems that it is now in the mode configure display settings.
It makes a desktop out of my desktop as the left screen and this one as the right screen, and so half the time I do not see my mouse curve because it's out of the projection. So I must at first make it the same image on all monitors, that default choice by Ubuntu. Why does it not come on up on the projector?
Feature.
Does someone know what the native resolution of the projector is?
The highest I was getting was 1024.
Yes. Because it's got camera, will try to change it.
Yes.
Now a screen is able to mirror the screen.
So, what I will do now, I go to the printer configuration program. Printing, system config printer, and add a new printer. And now you see, here are the printers which are detected, and it detected an Epson ME320 on the USB. But one thing is, you see, I don't have a printer connected. I have written a little fake backend, which simply tells CUPS that this printer is connected and this printer has that and that ID as it is registered on open printing, so that I can do the demo without having the printer. And when you have the physical printer and plug it, then it really starts automatically when you plug it. You don't need to start manually a system config printer. I choose this printer. And now it searches for drivers for it. At first it searches locally and will not find a driver for this printer. And so it goes over and searches on open printing. It found the model on open printing. And now it found the driver on open printing. And the driver is actually at Epson. Open printing only links to it. And now I can see this is the driver which serves for this printer. I can see the license is proprietary. I can even see the license text. And here's also written not tested by Ubuntu developers. It comes from Epson. It does not come from Ubuntu. And then here are some data. Here you see it comes from Epson, which is the manufacturer of this printer. And the port contact, here's a URL to get to the support forum for that driver. So every information which a user needs to decide whether he wants to use this driver is available. And so what you have to do is to simply say activate. And now I must enter the password because it needs root access because I'm installing a package now. And now it downloads the package from Epson. And it also verifies the signature, which is done by the distribution's package manager. And the needed data is also available at Epson and linked by open printing so that the stuff is found.
Can
Yes.
No? So the question is the driver, is this a distribution independent driver?
Yes, yes, it's a distribution independent package. The only problem is that from the distributions, the automatic download is up to now only shipped in the Ubuntu distribution, but you can see that it's a distribution independent package if with any other distribution you go with your web browser to the Open Printing website, go to that printer model and the recommended driver, then you click on the download link of the driver and you download a package which works with your distribution.
And also, the second question, the driver you downloaded, is this package manager managed?
Yes, it's package managed. It means if Epson replaces the driver on the server by a newer version, your every 24-hour update mechanism of your distro gets note of that and updates the driver for you. Like an update of the distro itself.
Does it only work for Ubuntu or also work
for... The 24-hour update mechanism works also with other distros. But the auto-download, the software which is needed on the client to do the auto-download is for now only on Ubuntu.
Well, that's
kind of
how different.
Yes. Red Hat does the following. As the distribution itself packages also drivers, the free software drivers, the distribution packaged by themselves, like HPLIP and so. They do not ship all the drivers with the basic distribution, but they have their driver packages on their server for download, and the driver packages from Red Hat, they contain virtual package names, which means these are named package names which can be requested by the installer, but alias names for the HPLIP package, and these package names are something like HP LaserJet 4L, HP LaserJet 4, HP LaserJet 3, and so on, and then the Red Hat distro does something like you install HP LaserJet 4L and this installs the HP lib package. And so the CD with which you do the initial installation of the distro does not contain printer drivers or only a few. And if you plug a printer, the Red Hat packages of the appropriate driver will be automatically installed.
I'm still confused. How many driver packages are there? Like from Ubuntu and Red Hat, do they have exact same package?
The free software all distros normally have, like HPLIP, Gutenprint, and so on, all distros normally have. They have them in packages. And on the Ubuntu distro, the default installation contains all these three software printer drivers. So if you simply start the live CD or install Ubuntu, you have all printer drivers, all three printer drivers. So if a printer is supported by a free software printer driver, it gets simply set up without downloading. In Ubuntu, it gets simply set up without downloading anything from the internet. And in Red Hat, the appropriate Red Hat package will be installed from a Red Hat mirror.
Can I just add something to that as well? This is Tim Moore here.
Yes, I hope I have described it more or less the way it works.
Yes, you've described it perfectly. One extra thing to mention, though, is that it's extensible, so that although Fedora, for example, comes configured to look at the Fedora package repository, you could easily add, for example, an Open Printing package repository or an HP package repository in which driver packages would be searched for and automatically installed using that method.
Yes, so I could later, for now at least, for the RPM packages, take the RPM packages appropriately, and then, for example, the RPM packages which are hosted on Ubuntu, the distribution independent package of the newest Gutenprint and of the newest Splix and what is all there, and the
PPD packages of Rico, I could tag and then at least the RPMs, and then they could also be downloaded by that mechanism.
Yeah, they just need to be in a Yum repository.
Yes. The only thing is, when one uses your mechanism, the server, which physically hosts the package, in this case Open Printing, must be registered on the in the printer setup tool of Fedora, or in the package sources of Fedora.
Yeah, the easiest way to configure it is to have a link on Open Printing's website, which points to just one RPM package that installs the configuration. So you click on the link. You want to install this package, you say yes, and then it configures the repository for you. So it's just basically one click on the website.
I could, for example, on a drive, for every package source, once Open Printing itself, and also every manufacturer for which packages are linked by Open Printing, like Epson, one could make a small RPM package which contains this configuration and put it on the appropriate driver side. Or one perhaps makes one package on Open Printing, one RPM package which contains all manufacturer the configuration for putting in all manufacturers, and can say Red Hat users, install this one package, and then you get automatically all drivers which Open Printing is linking to.
Whichever method is more convenient for you, really.
So if, let's say, my Linux box did not install the RSD package, so we don't do the auto driver download, so does that also instruct user to download the RSD package?
The packages, the binary driver packages, they have a dependency on the package name LSB. So this mechanism here, when the LSB package is not installed, the LSB package on the distro is a so-called meta package, which does not contain files but only dependencies on other packages. And with these dependencies, it installs all packages which are needed to make this distro LSB compliant. And this package is automatically installed by the package manager when one installs the driver, only the first time, when it's already there, or when you use or something else LSB-based and it's already there, it does not install it again. It's simply a dependency resolution mechanism of the distribution's package manager. And so I have installed here a package. When I close this, I get back to the process of the system config printer, and now you see it has found the PPD exactly matching to that printer. And as it does not ask you for PPD or driver, so it found the correct driver automatically, simply out of the package which it has downloaded, I say apply, and now I have the new printer. Here the Epson ME320, and then we can see in printer options. And here you see the options of the PPD file of the driver, which Epson has provided. And you see a lot of options, seems that you can make use of a lot of functionality of the printer. Yes, this was the short demo how such an auto-download works. Unfortunately, I don't see that the Rico people have bought the printer which they have promised. Otherwise, one could even show it with a real printer, as the Rico PPD files are also available as packages, and so the Ubuntu distribution would automatically download them. But not really. The Ubuntu distribution, as I have also the newest version, Netty, on my laptop, most probably contains already the PPD for this printer, so that it installs it straight away without downloading anything. If the printer is not so new that it's not even in that distribution, I don't know. We will bring the printer tomorrow.
I see the printer is in the hotel in the parking garage.
Ah, yes.
It's too heavy.
Ah, yes. Yes, then we will take it to here tomorrow. As for the demo for the auto-downloading this fake backend, which gives me the virtual apps and ME320 work much better.
So when you, let's say, when the Aspen updated the driver on their website.
Yes.
How does the user know the new driver is available?
When this download happens, the Epson site is registered in my system as a download source for packages. And this means that when every 24 hours the cron job, which looks for updates, is running, it looks also for updates on the Epson page, and not only on the Ubuntu sources of the installed distro. And so if a installed package is updated on the Epson side, this cron job will see it, and so the package manager pops up and says updates available, and then under the available updates there's also the new Epson driver. So it's the same mechanism as it is. They are for the security updates of the distro.
How about on Fedora?
It's on Fedora, it works too. Our server has full support for the YUM package.
Well, our server.
Our server has also full support for the YUM package manager of...
Our server means Open Printing Server?
Yes, Open Printing Server. And also, I have also told the manufacturers, and I hope, I didn't test it, but I hope that Epson did so, the Epson server will have the same support.
I still didn't get it. So on Fedora, after user downloaded the driver, the Fedora user check update. Do they go to Fedora repository to check update, or do they go to Aspen to check update?
Yes, the once a night cron job, it checks all package sources which are registered. And then when with the download of the Epson driver, the Epson site is registered as a package source, then it finds the updates there.
Fedora when they build the package, they also put a special tagging for each package to mark all the printer models that are supported in the package.
Yes, this mechanism is not yet supported, but in the future I will also support this mechanism.
What do you mean you are going to support this mechanism?
What?
The package is built by the manufacturer. So how can Open Printing support this? And how does it help?
It's the following. I must look into how one tags the packages and write perhaps a certain script which tags packages and provide this to the manufacturer so that they can put out tagged packages.
So it means in the
server
development kit.
Yes, to add a script which takes packages. At least it is possible now for RPM packages. For Debian packages, I must look whether the possibilities of Debian packages allow such a thing, and if not, perhaps write a script, the Debian helper or so, which does that.
And then you are now trying to photograph my screen with your built-in camera so that this can get... Oh, yeah, this one you photograph with the built-in camera, and then this you share out.
Yes.
So I can perhaps now uninstall the package and run the procedure again so that the phone participants can see it on our Open Printing Summit live TV.
Oh, that does look nice. Thank you.
What?
I mean, thank you.
You're welcome.
So for the PPD packages, of other free software packages, open packaging build, does that mean that Fedora do not need to build its own packages, only they use the packages from Open Printing App Store?
Fedora does not need to build their own packages. If I tag the packages which are offered at Open Printing, which means mainly the PPD packages, then when on a Fedora system, Open Printing is registered as a package source. This way of automatic driver download will work.
Well, SUSE does not work, right?
Yes, SUSE does not support Fedora's tag package. Or Tim, do you know whether they perhaps have overtaken it?
Well, the mechanism for tagging RPM packages is, I believe, upstream now in RPM. At least RPM has a mechanism for pluggable tagging. Mechanisms, if you see what I mean, and I think it's PyCups that contains the actual machinery to do the tagging. So as soon as SUSE uses a new enough version of RPM and of PyCups, then I believe it'll pick up the tags for them as well.
Now I will remove the package. No, but now which one is it? There are so many Epson packages that I simply would remove all of them. For doing another demo on live TV, I must at first clean up from now it restarts CUPS because it is at every uninstallation because it's made compatible to CUPS 1.1. So I start system config printer again. So anyone on the phone sees it now? At least on the virtual room?
Yes, I can see it. Sort of. It's quite bleached out, but it's better than nothing. Thank you.
Yes. And I click on the Epson ME320, which shows due to a fake CUPS backend, so that it looks for CUPS as it was plugged on the USB.
we are searching for drivers. Now it is searching on open printing and has found the model. And now it has found the driver at Epson. And you can see all the details about it. At first not tested by Ubuntu developers because it's from Epson and not from Ubuntu. License proprietary, you can see also the text of the license. And then you see some details, especially that it comes from Epson and where you can get support. And now to get it, you click on activate. You need root access. So my password are 8 circles. And now it downloads the driver and installs it. And also verifies the electronic signature. Now it's ready. Here's a green light. It says this driver is present. So you can close the driver manager, and now it adds the driver to the list of available PPDs, finds that it matches the printer, and finishes the setup of PrintView. You click on Apply to close the wizard. Now you can print a test page, but this we don't need now. And then I go into the properties, printer options, and you see the options of the driver, the printer setup. So, I hope everyone has seen it in this small live TV show. And it works much faster than 2.6 minutes ago when George was complaining that it's too slow.
Are you still using Jockey or
what?
You're not using Jockey anymore?
It is Jockey, but in Jockey some bugs got fixed. The main bug why it was slow was that it checked through the whole hardware of the system whether there's some component in the system for which a driver is needed. But we trigger the Jockey only that we have installed a printer. We will only want to know about the driver for the printer, not for the graphics card or the sound card and so on.
Okay, so that was just an implementation.
Yes, this was simply a bug in the implementation. I've reported it. Right. And
so I assume for this discovery mechanism, you are using some DSSD or identity device ID?
Yes, for network printer, the device IDs are obtained by SNMP and by DNSS.
So how
both methods are used to find printers, to scan the network.
How about, let's say, there's a firewall and the user cannot do the discovery? I remember Open Printing has a web interface, like API, web API to search for package. User can type in the printer model name.
Yes.
Does that API still work?
Yes. This is there inside for downloading a single PPD at least, which is enough for a printer, but it does not give you automatic updates. If you do the following now, to avoid that we get now into an auto-detection, I take other and enter URI, which for sure does not detect a printer model, so that I get it to the manual driver selection. And now you can do search for a printer driver to download. And now I can say Rico, tell me a name of a Rico model.
So I mean, you can type the name here, and the
also going to use the same, use the string here, the same as the device ID, right?
Yes, you can, you can also paste the device ID in the field. You can simply type make and model, and it finds it. This is
when they go to download the driver, just using the same mechanism.
Yes.
Right, so it's not like, in the past, I think they're not downloading using this way is not managed by package manager.
Yes, this searches for single PPDs. The web, web API supports both. Perhaps I should later on allow here also to search for packages.
Oh, right. Yeah, that sounds sensible.
So right now you search for single PPD.
Yes, this interface only searches for the single PPD.
This will be updated maybe in the future to also...
Yes.
Because right now...
It's a feature request for system config pointer.
So right now all the single PPD files, they are packaged by OpenPrinting, right?
Yes.
Cool. Much better than 2 years ago.
Yes, because it works.
One thing, it got a little bit delayed because I wanted to have it already in Maverick, so one distribution ago, but the Jockey upstream maintainer, he works at Canonical, and he was moved into another department for half a year, and so there was no Jockey upstream development for Maverick. And so, therefore, the auto-download only got into Netty. But the slowness bug was fixed in Maverick.
Cool. This might be a little off-topic, but are the PPD files the same then on OS X in terms of the TUPS commands that it knows and the languages and everything? Like you can put multiple languages in a single PPD file?
Yes, Rico can. George can tell about what Mac OS X users get and what Linux users get, whether they are different. As far as I know, the PPD files from Rico on OpenPrinting are especially for Linux.
For the Macintosh, basically you can use the Macintosh PPD files on Linux. There's only a few caveats. One is, on Macintosh, the LAN brick, the PPD file, maybe they're using CR only as LAN brick. But if you put that PPD file on Linux, they're going to complain, it doesn't work. So you can just use the easy script to replace the Macintosh LAN brick with Linux LAN brick. That'll make it work. And secondly, on the Macintosh PPD file, they usually have a couple of, depends on the PPD file. Some PPD file have some Apple extensions, like points to where the UI plugin is,
right.
And etc. Some Apple specific, like discovery, whatever things. I think those features will be just ignored by the Linux,
okay.
But you're missing those features.
Okay, so the cups will be different on both sides, right?
Right, this feature will work.
And Fumatic Whip you can also install on Mac OS X. There's a Mac OS X package on OpenPrinting.
Right, but the main thing is Macintosh usually really comes with like ICC profiles, with UI plugins, and those are not supported on Linux.
And languages on Linux, do you supply one language PPD or multiple
languages? They do support, on Linux, they do support multi-languages.
Yes, CUP supports multi-languages, but there's not yet a printing dialogue which supports them. We hoped we get one with a common printing dialogue.
On the CUP UI, Map UI, they do support multi-languages.
Oh. On which UI?
CUP
UI. Ah, the web UI, right. yes, for administrating the printer. Now I was thinking about when one wants to print, so when one says print in an application.
The client UI in the application.
Yes, the CUPS web interface supports them.
Mike Sweet's going to be here tomorrow and talking about cups in some detail, both current and future plans.
So, are you going to explain how to build the package? I read the instructions for the cups in the package. It's so many steps, like 20 or 30 steps.
Yes, the first thing is you have to install some packages which allow you to install. Perhaps we go to the
slide?
Yes, to the slide. Oh, nice background image. You have an image of yourself as background. But it was the electronic makeup mirror application.
No, because that mirrors and you can't use that. You have to get it so it's not mirrored. Okay, which slide do you want?
Yes, perhaps I should go through the slides.
Can you just use page up and page down?
Yes.
Yes, can you get into the full screen board?
That's about as... I'm trying to get rid of the sidebar, but...
It doesn't really go away.
It doesn't seem to want to go away.
Well...
What I did last time. Okay. You can just use the up and down arrows.
It's a poor man's book.
Yes, my box has full, the PDF has full screen, but my box doesn't support this virtual room. Yes, so I go to the way how packaging is done. Yes, what you have to do is to install the LSB versions of the compiler and the so-called LSB SDK, the Software Development Kit. This allows you to build LSB packages. Then there are a few files which add on to have the DDK. It's especially the .rpm macros file. And this file allows you to make up LSB compliant RPM packages.
Before you go into the details, what do we need to have before you make it LSB, before using LSB SDK? Let's say they already got a printer driver, and they have, let's say, in an Eclipse product file for the driver. Is that what we need? Is it sufficient, or we need to make
what file?
Like we use Eclipse.
Yes,
so what do we need to have? Like we need do we need to go from scratch, first into SDK? And then build some scratch of driver, or can we port existing drivers?
You can port existing drivers. When you have a driver in a form that you can build it under Linux, like the typical upstream firewall of Free Software, which means a bunch of C files and a make file, and also autoconf, automake stuff. If you have this, then you can use this
to build it also under the LSB to get an LSB binary of it. And it naturally you must take care that you only depend on things which are defined by the LSB and not on other things. If you must depend on other things, you would have to build the other things under the LSB too and add them to your package. For example, if your driver needs dbus, a dbus is not in the LSB.
Use like cup image and the libcup.
Yes, the libcups and libcups image are in the LSB. And if you take the newest LSB, the 4.1, also all the IPP and HTTP interfaces of the CUPS library are also included, not only the convenience API.
Yes. So I'm still confused how to set up the development environment for RSC SDK. So are we supposed to first install RSC SDK and then compile CUPS?
No, you don't need to compile CUPS. You install the LSB SDK, you install the .rpm mask port, as described here, and if you build then RPM packages using the new RPM mask port, this RPM package build builds for you an LSB package. It uses the LSB compiler wrappers, these packages.
Doing the modify on that make file?
Yes.
Or?
No, you don't need to modify it. The RPM with this mask port set does it all for you. And so if you have a Debian or Ubuntu distro, you naturally also need to install RPM build so that you can build RPMs on your machine.
Do you have any bundling requirements? You know, like tests, cups, tests, PD, or file sizes, or anything like this?
What?
Do you have any requirements for bundling? Like there's this program called cups, tests, PD, which is the syntax checking on PD files.
Yes. What you should do also is to run cups, tests, PD over your PD. It would be very nice, naturally, if the package build process does it and when it fails on the CPD, it has the build process failed.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also manually do the check prior running CUPS test PPD over the CPD to check whether the PPDs are really compatible with CUPS.
So do you have these guidelines somewhere written down?
Yes, it's a web page. And these slides are simply a summary of the web page, which is more in short to call the web page. And the link for the web page is also in the slides at the end. Here are some more details, and especially these RPM mark ports, they take care of everything that the package gets an LSB package and that the package fulfills all requirements that it works as a distribution independent printer driver package. Without interfering with anything which comes from the distribution. Especially that everything is installed in opt and so does not interfere with any files if, for example, the same driver in another version is already installed by the distribution.
So let's see how program. Let's give me like a raster to recall filter.
Yes.
That's one binary.
Yes.
And they have a whole bunch of TPD files.
how do we know, okay, where to install the CDFL, where to install the binary?
The RPM macro set takes care of that. By simply using the macros as described later on on these slides or on the website, everything is put into the right place.
So what do we need to give to the same thing to the previous slide about the RPM macros?
Yes. You download that file, the RPM macros file, the link is on the web page.
Right.
And you install it as described here in etc RPMRC or in your .rpmrc of your user account. And then you have the macros for building RPM packages. And in this situation, as you described, raster to RPM plus PPD file, or raster to RICO plus PPD file, the most similar package which already exists is the Flix package. So one thing is you download the SRPM, the source RPM of the Flix package, and have a look into it so that you have an example how the spec file for such an RPM looks like. And then perhaps you simply modify the spec file of package to do the work on your package.
Is RPM build only for packaging or also to the build?
It is for building and packaging. It does this in one. The spec file is a header with a sequence of scripts where the most script work is hidden in macros.
It didn't tell me, okay, let's see, I have a source directory for the raster to RICO. And then tell me, okay, which directory is this? The binary, is it in root directory, or is it in bin directory, or is it in filter directory? It doesn't ask me anything about that here. So how do I start using it?
It's the following. If you have a make file, and your make file, a standard make file that make builds your stuff, and make install installs it in the usual cups, locations as user libcup filter and so. If you have this make file and so can build and install a package like you can do it with a standard free software project. If you take this source with the make file and the sources as a source tarball, and let RPM build it for you using my macro set. Then this macro set does automatically the needed modification that the stuff is installed in the appropriate ops directory.
So let's say my makefile, they install the CPD files in user share cap.
Yes.
Model, whatever. And but by IRC standard, it should be going to like opt some drivers or CPD. So how do your macro modify my make files or how?
It is the following: if your make file uses appropriate standard mechanism, as cap config and the possibility that you can and inside the make file variables for the destination directories, this macro set will call the make file with command line options, so which overwrites overwrites the variables, setting them to the other path. And so under the macro set, the files get installed in opt. Especially it changes the destdir variable, which is the standard variable used in make files. It works best if you use autoconf and automake.
But that didn't give me the other destination directories. Don't give me those. They only give me make clean, right? Don't give me make in store. I mean,
said that.
Yes, your makefile must be able to do make and make install. And if it gets too much work for you to make a makefile which contains this functionality make install and so, you do not necessarily need to make a makefile where the macros can substitute everything. You can also in the spec file manually copy files to certain places. You don't even need to use make. You can write your command,
well,
your compiler command in the build
section. The whole point of using RFC is users don't need to run make, right?
What?
I think the whole point of using RFC is users don't need to run make.
Who wants to make is you when you are making the package. You want make in the spec file.
Right, and then you provide the binaries.
And then binary packages are built by RPM. And this is a binary RPM package. And this binary RPM package, the user only needs to install. And one thing is, in the documentation is also described where the files have to go, not only which macros you can call for that. And so you can also, in the spec file, you don't call only macros, you can also simply use normal shell script commands. You can also, in the spec file, in the build section and install section, directly call commands like the compiler or copying them into the right directories for the installation, this also works. So then if your makefile is not written in a way that the macros can overwrite it correctly, then you can also really manually distribute the files by means of the makefile.
It has
used
the macro
while
they're not use the RFC compiler, right?
What?
They have to use RPM micro, because they need to use the RFC.
Yes, there are many macros. There are one macros for doing the install, which means putting the files into the correct op directory, and there are other macros to make sure that the LSD compiler and wrappers are used. You can, for example, for the compile process use macros, and for the install process copy files manually, so you can mix, so you can use what you need and what is better for you.
Too many options.
And perhaps to find out how it works, you should perhaps really take the source package of the SRPM of Split and look into the spec file, look how the make files and everything in the Split source tarball are, and if then you make your source tarball of your driver as similar as possible with Split, then it will work.
So, Till, does the website explanation of the page and explanation of this mention that example of looking at the splits?
I must look, because it was now a spontaneous idea of me.
Okay, because I think that's a pretty important thing.
Yes.
And here's an example of what it does that you can look at, and then you can decide if you want to write your make and make install to match that, or do you want to do part of it by a sample script that follows the make?
Yes, for example, one thing, if I package a new program for a distro, which was never packaged for that distro, I also usually look for a program which is as similar as possible in terms of the packaging.
and then I take the packaging stuff of that problem and modify it that it packages my problem instead of the original. Yes, and here's also listed where the directories, where the stuff has to go. And coming up to the packaging, and if you compare with Flix and try it out, and if you get stuck in some point, you can simply mail me in which point you get stuck, then send me the files which you have, and then I can help you at that point.
I think it'd be easier to separate the RSC packaging, RPM packaging part, the real build part.
So you mean so it was two steps that were
right. So let's say if I let's say for Macintosh, I build a Macintosh package. The first step I use Xcode whatever to build the files, build binaries, and then next step I use like package maker and then tell them okay, grab top maker directory, put everything I need into that directory, run package maker here, root directory, and make new package. In that case,
yes,
we can the build because every team of developers is a different environment. Some maybe write their own makefile in different styles,
right.
And maybe using some Eclipse, which do not write their makefile by 7 manually. Only use some other ways. So
I must look into my package generator script, which I use for the server, because I don't remember exactly. I think it can also package directory trees, but I'm not sure, not only pure PPD files.
So is that easier?
And perhaps one can introduce another alternative method for packaging up drivers with separate pieces.
So is that easier? First I install RSD SDK package, then in my own project makefile, I replace G++ or GCC compiler
by LSB
G++. By RSC G++ compiler.
Yes,
and
yes.
And then build my project and get the binary.
Yes.
And then I copy the binary, copy the PPD file, and then they...
And there's something in...
Yeah,
it
was connection.
It's coming back, we hope. So you're not projecting anywhere but right here, right now.
Too many people on the conference are reading email currently, so that there's no bandwidth to get the pictures out.
So how does Epson create a package? Or step?
I think they make it in the classic RPM build way, so that they use the RPM build with a macro, so that an RPM package is built with compilation under LSD.
Because on the Linux, the same source code for Rust for filter, most likely it works for both Macintosh platform and for Linux platform.
Yes.
And Macintosh is also for RPM.
Yes.
So
they have their own package for
them. Right. So it's just you make the build on the Linux, the RPM build, the same source code will not build on Macintosh.
Yes.
So that's the problem I see.
Yes, and usually you have a source tarball with a make file, and this builds everywhere.
Right.
And for this, for the Linux RPM package, you let the RPM spec file build this, and this builds then using, for example, using macros so that it is built in LSB format. And for Macintosh, you simply call the make file and install it in a certain directory, and then the Macintosh package are packaged for you.
No, actually, Macintosh don't do Mac messages store on Macintosh. Not really use. I use Packet Maker to, this is a couple years ago, I use Packet Maker to make a package directly in store. They don't use your source code for
Macintosh. Yes, I know that they don't use they have also a kind of packages and not distributing source code. So for Macintosh, you also you run your make file to compile it and make install into a certain directory where the package maker can make a package out of it.
Right.
And for Linux, you put your make call and your make install call into the spec file of the RPM, and then the RPM build once make and make install for you and package.
Actually, I think before the whole point of using RSC build is not to provide make install, because many users don't like to install from source. So,
never require user to install from source.
No, but you can build an RSC binary package, it's supposed to be able to run on every.
This I'm saying. We want to build a package, a binary LSB package. And this for Linux RPM build does. And what you need for both is that you have the source code together with the make file, so that for Linux RPM build can use this source code with the make file, and for Mac you do you run it and afterwards you run the package maker. So in both, and then you have for both operating systems a binary package. So any other questions about driver packaging? Everything is clear for everyone.
Well, you can answer.
Just question, if you can manually set up the user, it will also pass through the people file manually and then set up manually the user so that when you run the RPM build, it can also create the copy.
What do you mean?
Aside from the question earlier that RPM build does the compiling,
yes.
Then compile our source code and then manually set up the builder.
Yes, this is also possible. RPM can the RPM build can also simply take existing files and packaging them together.
Yes.
And I have also a script for that, currently only using on the server, but I can add to the documentation an alternative way using that script that you can make a driver package and where you have compiled the stuff before.
Yeah, because we have separate requirements for compiling from the RPM field, a separate step.
So this is perhaps better if you have simpler make files, or if you have make files which are not done
the Linux manner in which with which the hardware test can do the appropriate override. Or if you simply put manually files in a directory tree and want to package that up.
Can openprinting.org host can openprinting host proprietary binary driver?
Currently no. So what has to be done is that Rico has to host them and openprinting to link them, like it is done with Epson. We usually have our own repository, like for RPM, as I described in your presentation. Yes. You set up a repository following the instructions, so it allows package manager control downloads on RPM and Debian packages. And you create the RPM packages, run the script for generating the Debian repository from the RPM packages, and also run the script for indexing the RPM package repository. And then you give us you make the XML files, the formatting XML files, which contain the linking and all the information about license, and supplier, support context, and so on. We put up these XML files into the database, and then your drivers are available.
Is that you can
generate the one time? There is no script, but as an example, you can take the formatic DB and formatic DB non-free download them from open printing and see the XML files which are inside there as an example.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, and the XML files from Epson which contain all the linking to the drivers on Epson side, you find in the formatic DB non-free package.
They just email you the binary and the PDB file and you just become the help. Can we just email you the filter binary and PDB and you return us, make a storage, return us a package. So
I can give you a script and this makes easily a package.
So basically, what we need to do is just instead of using GCC or G++, we use RSD GCC or RSD G++.
Yeah.
And we build it, and we have a binary,
DVD. I will give you a download. I will add to the documentation a download link to that script, which takes in a tree of files and puts out an RPM package.
Right. So you just take two inputs. One is binary, one is DVD directory.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you buy till dinner, then he'll do that for you.
It's very simple.
Other questions about building for drivers?
Yes, and for the signing, there are also step-by-step instructions which I have added. So, because the signing is also important that the distributions take the drivers for auto-download. Yes, it's these steps here.
you generate a GPG key, and then you need to have an HTTPS file with an SSL certificate which has been signed by an official registrar, and when you put up your key fingerprint there and you sign your packages in your package repository as described below, and put the GPG key itself into the key server network, then the distributions are able to verify your keys and your packages that they are really yours.
So the first step is make build your own binary driver.
Yes, you build.
The second step is make an RPM package.
Yes, yes.
The third step is get a GPG key.
The third step is to create a repository from the packages, and it means you have
repositories.
Yes, right. Yes, you have to put them in a certain order onto a server so that package managers can download them. And for this there are also programs and scripts. For the RPM, you put them in this scheme,
so with the RPM,
and run and create repo over it to index them.
So with the RPM build, the RPM macro to create a repository for?
The RPM build creates only the packages.
Only the RPM.
Yes. Yeah. And then on a web server, you set up this directory tree as you can see it here, and put in your packages there.
So I also have, let's say, two machines. One machine running 32-bit build, another machine running 64-bit build.
Yes.
And then both machines using RPM micro.
Yes.
And then I copy these two and put it together
onto a web server.
Into one repository.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, on a web server, and you put them into the appropriate directories as shown here.
What is NoARC?
NoARC are architecture independent packages. For example, packages which contain only PPDs and scripts and no compiled programs.
Ah,
but
for
no
executable.
Yes. Yes. So all the PPDs on open printing, your PPDs on open printing, they are NoARC packages.
Okay.
Yes, and RPM packages, they call it NoARC because it is no specific architecture, it's all architectures, and in Debian packages they call them all because it's for all architectures. And you index the RPM repository by running this create repo program, which is a free software which one can download. And forgetting also Debian packages, you don't need to know anything about Debian packages, you only need to run a script over the RPM packages, and this script creates the Debian repository and puts in the Debian equivalent of your RPM package into that repository. And when you run the script again with another RPM package, it adds the Debian made out of the RPM package to the repository. And so you build up the Debian repository. And this also automatically indexes the repository after each one of the scripts, so that each new package is also indexed. And with this, you have repositories of your packages. And the next step is signing the packages.
So we can now just use an existing Windows FTP or Windows Server to copy the file there. We need to make a Linux server with RPM software to host the package.
Yes, it's better to have a Linux server because the the indexing programs and the script which makes Debian out of the RPMs, these are Linux programs. And to avoid that, you need an extra server hardware. You can perhaps run a virtual machine on your Windows server, which runs Linux.
I need a new server. It's not sure a trivial thing. So, okay.
And the server must be a 64-bit hardware, so that the conversion from RPM to Debian works with packages of both architectures.
Is that documented on the website?
Yes, it's documented. It's even documented here. That here it's written. You need a 64-bit machine with 64-bit Linux installed as the server. And then when you have the repositories, you index them and you sign them. In RPM, you sign the actual packages individually, but on Debian, you sign the repository. You sign the index files of the repository, which indirectly signs the packages. And for that, you must at first generate a GPG key. And when you have this key, you must generate the fingerprint and put this fingerprint up on your HTTPS server with a registered SSL certificate. And you must register your GPG key in the key server network, so that the package manager can download your actual key, and you must sign your packages as described here, where the RPM packages are signed individually, and for Debian the repository, you sign the repository. So this means the RPM packages you can actually sign directly after building, before uploading to the server. And the Debian packages, you sign the repository, so you sign files on the server which are part of the Debian indexing. So you can sign the Debian packages only after you have run the index, the conversion and indexing. Yes, and this is what you must put into the XML file for adding your packages to the database. And getting this nice information window of Jockey when an automatic download. Yes, and this is the procedure to get this all, when you have all done all this, to get it really, to get it onto the OpenBridging server. Any other questions?
also put a link from the Open Printing website to the server package.
It is in the XML file. The link is one entry in the XML file.
That last bullet there in the schematic XML file. That's why on the next screen he said, don't change the link, don't change the package names, but remember to resign them if you update the package. Because if you change the link, package name or the link, then it'll, you know, break.
Yeah.
The XML file.
Yes, you would need to update the XML file too. And this only helps new users. If someone has already installed the package, then the automatic updates will not work anymore when the repository is somewhere else. Because he has the link then on his local machine for the automatic update. Therefore, it's very important to have the repositories always under the same link and on the same place. And for example, Linux distributions are all taking care of that the places of the packages are never changed. And unfortunately, one sees a lot that websites of hardware manufacturers are changing all the time. And if one has, for example, links to the printer page of the manufacturer in the Open Printing database, they very easily get broken because the manufacturer reorganizes their website much too often.
Other than this auto-downloadable package, we can, if we only create a